Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, folks. This is your host, Gary Jenkins. I'm here in the deep, dark confines of the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4 with my friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, it's good to be back. You know, our last podcast, we had our good friend Bill Owsley, retired FBI agent William Owsley, and he told a very interesting story about an investigation of a man in the mob in Kansas City named Jimmy Duarte. And Duarte and about three other men tried to take over a whole county down in the northwest part of Oklahoma and failed. And they all went to jail, but they didn't go to jail for very long. If you listen to it, it was kind of interesting. The tickets for the live show, the live podcast show, are going.
You probably haven't even mentioned this yet at all on your podcast in the previous episode.
I have not mentioned this.
If people go to the website, they're going to see this, that there's actually on Wednesday, November 4th at the Uptown Arts Bar, 7 p.m., we're doing a live taping, live recording session of Gangland Wire Crime Stories. And you can get tickets through ganglandwire.com.
Correct.
Yourself, myself, really, I'm not much. I'm just, you know, the extra here.
He's just the extra expert here.
And I'm no expert at anything, really. Yeah, but I can bring some microphones and we can record it all as well.
That's what we want to do.
Gary Jenkins and our special guest.
Terrence O'Malley, the producer and author of the book and the movie documentary film by the same name, Black Hand Straw Man. And you know what we're going to talk about, don't you, Aaron? The mob and the politicians, because it's the day after election day in Kansas City, and so we think that would be appropriate.
Seems like a good time to talk about how the mob and the politicians work together.
Right, right.
History of that.
Yes, we do have. We go way back into the 30s, and that's what Terrence, he's kind of an expert on the 30s and 40s and 50s particularly, and I'm more, my area of expertise is more in the 70s, and so he'll talk about kind of how it got started and some of the early flamboyant ways that Johnny Lazy and Charlie Bonaggio and Charlie Gargatta and some of those early mob bosses made inroads into Jackson County and Kansas City politics. They, you know, with Tom Pendergast, they actually
the Democratic Club.
Yeah, they owned the whole city at one time. And you know, ironic as it is, Bonaggio and Gargatta ended up getting killed in the floor of the Northside Democratic Club at Truman and about Charlotte. And
is that in your app?
That's in my app. You can go find that in my app. Yes, you can.
I was just reading on Wikipedia about those two guys, four bullets to the head, pretty much each of them.
Right, right.
No one ever figured out who did it.
No. And the famous picture that was taken and was in the newspaper had a smiling Harry Truman in his portrait looking out over the murder scene, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the poster on my website, you'll see the Northside Democratic Club on the letterhead. It had Tom Pendergast, it had Jim Pendergast, and it had Harry Truman as officers in this Democratic Club, which were hand in glove with the mafia in Kansas City at that point in time. So having said all that, I think Aaron's giving you there's a Facebook page too. Go to my Facebook, Gangland Wire, and I have an event and accept an invitation or say that you're going on that.
And then go buy a ticket.
So we kind of have some idea. They're starting to go. We'd like to know there's limited seating. What is there, 60?
60, 65, maybe seats if we cram them in the main room.
In the main room.
And then the whole venue has 120.
So there's another 60 seats if you want to sit out in the bar and drink
and
while we're in there.
Well,
talking.
There's video so they could actually still see and the audio will patch through to the main bar.
Oh, okay.
So they can still hear. We're going to sell as many of those tickets as we can up to the 120.
Okay.
But, But you may not be able to get in the actual room unless you get there early.
Right.
And if you get there early, though, the good news is there's a meet and greet with Gary Jenkins and Terrence O'Malley.
Yeah, and we'll be 15 minutes or so after we get done talking for questions, too. There's another program at 9 o'clock, so we'll stop about 8:45 and take questions.
And do a Q&A.
Do a Q&A, correct. So let's go ahead and get going tonight. You know, and I have a couple more people to thank. A Mr. Gaither, Ms. Stacy Gaither, sent us a nice little donation. And, oh, I forgot to bring the piece. I'll have to thank this person next time. So,
but you had another person hit the donate button?
I've had a couple more people hit the donate button. That's, you know, that let me get somebody about, well, I don't know. I've been getting average about one a week now. You know, keep hitting the donate button, folks, because we got expenses. We got to pay for this studio time, and I've got some Freedom of Information Act requests. I sent one out on Tiger Cartarello to the ATF. He was Tiger. If you remember Tiger's records, he sold. He was one of the more successful LP record album sale or stores in the city. And every record he had in there was stolen by a shoplifter. And
stocked his store.
They did not steal from his store. They stole from all the different little shopping centers all over the Midwest and then brought them to Tiger. He gave him 25 cents on the dollar. And then he'd sell them for about 75 cents on the dollar. So you get a brand new latest popular album back in the 70s for, you know, if it was $5, you get it for $4 there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a mob guy. He was one of Willie Camisano's guys, and he ended up dying a tragic death. We'll talk about that actually a little bit later tonight in Tiger's death.
Well, when you're doing a Freedom Information Act, you really don't have any idea how big the case file is.
No, you don't. It's kind of tough. I got one. It was 3,000 pages, and they wanted a lot of money for that, and I didn't know. I elected to get a shorter version, which was a lot less money. It was 300 pages, and it didn't really have everything I wanted, so it's kind of a crapshoot, but you got to do it.
Because they charge you on the per-page basis?
Right. They charge you a search fee, and then they give you so many pages for free.
Mm-hmm.
I think in that case it was $25, and for the 300 pages – and that was for search fee, and I think there wasn't any printing charge. But it went in, that 3,000 thing, they didn't tell. They said it's going to be a lot of money.
Yeah.
So that's because
somebody's
got
to actually pull the case file. They've got a. They're not sending you an original. They're making a photocopy.
Right. They got to pull the files, and then they got to photocopy them, and then they put them on a disc and send me a disc, which is kind of nice. I don't have all that paper, but
you just have a disc.
Just have a disc, but it's a lot of work, and they do part of it for free, but if it gets into very much, then.
Well, if you're 300 pages, then they're going to start. They're definitely charging.
No, oh, yeah, that was $25, so. So, and you know, most of them, 300 pages is nothing, and 200 pages of it was nothing. I mean, if I could look through and say, you know, I don't want those 200 pages, I just want this 100 page, it would be a lot easier.
Yeah.
But you can't do that. They give you everything. You can't stand over their shoulder. So that's how that works, the Freedom of Information Act.
You got to know who you're asking for. You must have to know some details about the person you're asking.
Well, that and you
case numbers
and
or
you
anything.
Gotta, no, you got to just prove they're dead.
Okay.
That's all you got to do is prove they're dead, and they have to be able to find them, give them some kind of identifiers, and then they go pull everything.
Wait, so you have to go get it like a death certificate from the
well,
is that,
you know what I found is I can just, all I got, if I got a newspaper article that says they were killed, why, that works. So I did that with the Spiro brothers. I found one newspaper article that had all three names and said all three were dead. So they then let me have the file or a file, the 300 page file on the Spiro brothers.
Because
that was
you were
one
able to use
3,000.
That newspaper print.
Yeah.
I just you know, you got an Instagram account now.
Yeah, I do.
Gangland Wire. On the Instagram. I had downloaded one of the mobsters that we're maybe be talking about on the 4th of November, and I posted up one. You saw that. I had posted one before, which was Tom Pendergast.
Right.
I made like a little announcement.
Yeah, a picture of him.
And then there was another one, and I found there was an online in the references in the Wikipedia, the cemetery location for him.
Oh, yeah, over at St. Mary's over on 22nd Cleveland, Johnny Lazy, and they're all buried over there.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm trying to pull it up right now. I couldn't remember the Wikipedia. It was Bellagio, is it?
Bellagio.
Charlie
Bellagio. He should be buried at St. Mary's over there, 22nd Cleveland.
Is that in your app?
I didn't put the cemetery in my app.
You might want to add those locations.
I could. That's,
I think that, at least if they knock on the door, no one's going to get upset.
Right, right. They wouldn't mind. It's kind of a dicey area of town. Most people will not be real comfortable over there, 22nd Cleveland. But it's not for the faint of heart to go over to that cemetery. Okay, well let's get started.
Let's dive in.
Tonight we're going to talk about mob hits. That's a popular topic. There's been many a film and story written about mob hitmen, and people seem to like hitmen and like to know about hits, and that's the power of the mob. That is the way that they maintain power, through fear and intimidation. And if people think they're going to get hit, then they might do something that they normally wouldn't do. And so that's an important tool in the mob toolbox. We're going to go back in the early days, in the Black Hand days. They were extorting money from other Italian shopkeepers and threatening to kill them if they didn't pay the money. And this was down in what we call Little Italy in Kansas City. And there's a main street that runs east and west that borders Little Italy and the city market. It's called Independence Avenue. And back in the 20s and 30s, there were signboards that ran perpendicular to Independence Avenue. Of course, it doesn't look like anything like it does now. That's mainly freeway down through there now. But there were signboards that ran perpendicular, and they had a term. They were going to signboard a guy. And what that meant, if they knew somebody was going to be walking, say, back from downtown or back from the city market area back over to where the houses were in Little Italy, which was to the east of that, at night, and they kind of had a pattern on them, they knew they always walked that way, somebody with a shotgun or a pistol, mainly a shotgun, would hide behind one of those signboards, and as they walked by the signboard, they'd step out and kill them. And that was known as signboarding a guy. So if somebody says they're going to signboard you, that's what it means. They're going to kill you from behind us, hidden from behind a signboard.
And there was a number of attempts, but people that were killed, shopkeepers.
There were people that were killed walking by those signboards. Yeah, those shopkeepers had to pay. If they didn't pay, then they were subject to be killed. And there's kind of two tactics to hit a guy, shall we say.
We're not talking about signboarding at this point.
Well, signboarding is one of the two tactics. Now, okay. Signboarding was more of a, I guess, used as a kind of a specific example and kind of a colorful term of signboarding a guy, something you never hear in modern times, because the signboards are way off the highway now.
Now you got to billboard somebody.
Now you got to billboard somebody, and you got to get them with a sniper rifle as they drive by in their car. It's a little hard to do. Times have changed.
But the second tactic?
Yeah. Okay. The first tactic is the most popular tactic later on with the mob is you get a friend. Say, Aaron and I are friends, and I say, Aaron, you want to go to the ball game tonight, and let's go out and eat and have a few drinks. And Aaron said, well, yeah, sure, that sounds good. And so we go out and we start drinking, and I don't drink very much, and I try to get Aaron to drink a lot and get him a little bit woozy and chummy and not on his best game. And then he said, well, we're going to go to the ball game. Maybe we go to the ball game. And then we run into a friend there. And he said, well, you know, give me a ride home. And so the friend leaves the ball game with you, and he gets in the back seat. And
now it's the three of us.
So now there's the three of us. Aaron's in the right front seat, and this third guy's in the back seat, and I'm driving. Then I say, you know, I got to pee, man. Let's pull over in this alley. So I pull over in this alley, and the guy in the back seat then does the deal. He either shoots him in the back of the head, or maybe takes a garrote and puts it over around his neck and chokes him out if I don't want to get blood and brains all over the inside of my car. Or maybe I even pull a gun and both of us start popping him. And so then we go dispose the body. Usually we already have a hole. If we don't want the body found, we'll already have a hole dug. They always say, if you're going to go kill somebody, already have your hole dug. So
you don't have to sit there and dig a hole.
Right. You don't want to sit there and dig a hole
with the dead body.
Car. Exactly, Aaron. And you'd make a pretty good hitman, Aaron. You catch on quick.
I'm just saying. Because I figured we get in the car when you meet your friend at the ballpark. I was going to sit in the back seat.
Yeah, well, we could do that too. You just turn around, both turn around. It's kind of better you're more vulnerable in that passenger's seat with
front
somebody
side,
right behind you. So
give you the Frank Nash.
Yeah, or then they can do a garrote around your neck and not waste the bullet or not leave that bullet evidence. You know, when you use a bullet, you leave a lot of evidence. Plus, you mess up the inside of your car. So that's one way you isolate the person. And that was really popular in the 60s and 70s. And I talked about Tiger Carterello. That's probably the way he went. He was strangled. But we'll talk about more about that later.
But they found him?
Yeah, found him in his car. Then they'll, you know, if they want him found. If the mob wants to leave a message, they'll have you found. Mm-hmm. Your body will be found. In Tiger's case, he was found with the pockets. His trouser pockets were slit open. And what that means is he was stealing money from somebody. Mm-hmm. And that's why he was killed. So they will leave a message of some kind. You may or may not be able to, police may or may not be able to interpret it. That one was easy to interpret. So that's, you know, that's.
But a lot of times in those instances, the guy just disappears and you never find him.
Right. And if somebody wants the body to disappear, then you'll never find it. And sometimes you'll never find. An unusual one was Sal Manzo. Sal Manzo was probably going to have a lot of pressure put on him. He was involved with a illegal gambling in a bingo operation in which was kind of they had a scam charity that the money was supposed to be going to, and it really wasn't. And he was running the bingo operation. And the feds were getting ready to come down on it, and I think they probably thought Sal might break, and Sal disappeared. But Sal had a lot of relatives, and so they wanted people to know. They didn't want the evidence around for the police to even look at the body or find out anything about where the crime scene might be, but they wanted the family to know and people to know that he'd been killed. And so they called, an anonymous phone caller called a police detective at the time named Frank Mazuka, who lived over in the North End, was an Italian guy that grew up with all the guys, but he was not a crook or anything. He was just an Italian guy who was a police officer. And I say that because a lot of times people think, oh, well, he must have been in with the mafia, but he wasn't. Frank wasn't. He was a square shooter. And they called him up and said, you can tell the family, you can tell Sal's family to look in a particular trash can on a corner up on St. John, I think about Belmont. And so they went up there, and there was all Sal's clothes that he was wearing the last time he was seen in that trash can, but no Sal. Matter of fact, his family, I had questions today. The family, Sal has a relative that's a judge up in Minnesota, and at one of my screenings in Gangland Wire, I had somebody in the audience catch me afterwards and say, you know, the family still would like to know if there's any way police can figure out where his body is. And, and you know, I kind of ask around, but there really isn't any way. You know, there just is no way. And nobody ever came forward and said, yeah, I know about the Sal Manzo hit. And, you know.
Well, even possible suspects.
Right. I mean, there's no statute of limitations on murder. And so
no one's going to come forward.
Plus, you know, mob guys are like this. If two of us have a secret and one of us is dead, then, you know, the secret never gets out. So, yeah. You know, they're really careful. You know, they will. Sometimes they'll do a hit with a guy and then turn around and kill the guy they did a hit with. So, you know, it's a cruel world in that world. But now the other way, and the way I'm going to talk about a couple of particular early hits, and that it holds true today. If the person you want to hit is on guard against you, if they already their antenna is up, and you're not going to be able to isolate them more than likely, then you got to ambush them in some way. And signboarding was one way of ambushing them. The other way is just, you know, you just go catch them in a particular situation where they're vulnerable in any way, walking down the street late at night. And there was early on, there was one of the first ones was a Kansas City, Missouri police officer named Joseph Ramo. He was an Italian guy, lived over in the North End, and he had pursued the Black Hand rigorously, and they did not like Officer Ramo. He was told, you know, you got to leave us alone or something's going to happen, and he wouldn't back off. He wouldn't back off, and one day he was off duty. He was over around the city market playing cards and drinking, and which put him vulnerable. And he lived, he was around 4th and Holmes, and he was walking north on 4th to 5th Street on Holmes. And there's an alley there. And as he walked by that alley, somebody's laying wait for him, just like a signboarding, and just stepped out of that alley and shot him and killed him.
And just left his body laying
just
there?
Just left his body laying there. So there was an officer, and what's it's interesting that the day this guy dies, or not the day, but the year this guy dies, there's a new Italian police officer named Louis Olivero who comes on the job. And he also is Square John. He also is, his cop had been in Italy, his dad had been a cop in Italy, and what do they call that, the Cabinieri? He'd been a Cabinieri in Italy, and he knew about the Black Hand, and he knew about the Mafia, and he knew their ways, and he also pursued them without fear or favor. And they warned him and warned him and warned him, you know, you got to leave us alone. But he had, you know, he was getting inside knowledge because he lived in the neighborhood. He had friends in the neighborhood. So, you know, he kept after him. And he had one threat. He got a written threat. I read this in Bill Owsley's book, Open City. He said, "We're tired of you. We put $1,300 on you and we'll double that if you don't stop." So Louis Olivero was on his guard. He knew they were trying to kill him. And in 1915, a fire was set in his apartment, and that was up at, it was at 615 Independence Avenue. And don't ask me if I got that in my thing, because that's nothing but a freeway right now, 615 Independence Avenue. Right there, just somewhere between Troost and Paseo would be right along in there. So,
but there'd be the freeway.
There'd be nothing there really to speak of than to take a picture of. So, during this time, somebody set this fire, and you know he was really on high alert. But he wanted to strike back, and he really wasn't getting much help on the police with the police department, because most of them were being paid off back those in those days. And he had a pretty good informant, and he became a source for a Kansas City Star reporter, and they started doing a series of articles. He was quoted as the official. Like now they call it an unnamed White House official. Well, mm-hmm. They just called him the official in these newspaper reports, and they did an expose on the inner workings of the Black Hand, and all the mob guys, they knew this had to be Olivero. He was the only guy outside of their inner circle that could find out this kind of information. They kind of redoubled their efforts, and then he just left the police department, but they did not forget. And he worked for U.S. Immigration for a while. And then in 1929, he was working as a booking clerk for the Jackson County Jail. And he remained cautious, but he wasn't cautious enough, and he was walking away from his house. And obviously they'd been... You just run a surveillance on a guy, or you talk to some neighbors, and you get a pattern on them. And most people have a pattern. You mm-hmm. have a pattern. I have a pattern. Most people have a pattern.
Well, if they have a job, they're going to get up in the morning.
Right.
They're going to come home after work.
Right, exactly. And so they caught him walking away from his home, which was 808 Lydia. And I need to put that one on my, that's a good one.
I think
there is an 808 Lydia. There might even be still a house there, but that's over by... the osteopathic hospital and all those buildings that have been fixed up. So there may not be. I have to look. But he was walking up the street, and a dark sedan pulled up behind him, jumped out, and shotgunned him in the face, and he died on the spot. So in these early days, they didn't really, not that I, any of the reports I've read show that sophistication of trying to get a person, get a friend to set a person up and get them in a quiet place. They isolate them. And they mainly just blasted you on the street. Now, that'll become.
But when it's somebody like it's a police officer, I mean,
yeah,
a civilian or another known mob, you know.
Yeah.
Associate who dies, there's not nearly as much concern, I would think, with the police force
right.
as there is when it's an actual police officer.
Yeah, and especially back in those days, if it was the police force wouldn't even investigate it if it was just another mob guy. They would investigate it a little bit
to figure out who it was.
Citizen, and if it was another police officer, they would investigate it a lot. So,
yeah.
But they never solved any of those. Talk about, we'll go forward just a little bit into the 1930s. There was a pretty famous hit that went down about 1 o'clock in the morning at Armor and Troost. And they really had to plan this one out. There was a bootlegger and gangster named Ferris J. Anthon. And he was, and there was an early term they put, he was on the spot. If you were on the spot, there was a contract out on you. That comes, that term comes out.
That's what they would call it.
Right, on the spot. Mr. Anthon, his wife, and mother-in-law were parking in front of the Cavalier Hotel. A lot of people lived in those hotels out there in Midtown on Armor. If you look, go up and down Armor Road, you'll see that's where John Lazy, he lived about six blocks east of there in the Park Place Hotel. And so they're like, they had a doorman and a lobby. And a desk, and but mainly people just lived there. So as he pulled up in front of the Cavalier Hotel and got out of his car, there was two guys laying in wait for him and started shooting at him, and they shot him and killed him. But just as this happened, this is like the policeman's dream. We used to, in the intelligence unit, we'd cruise these streets, and because we knew the guys, we knew what they looked like, knew their cars, and we were hoping we could catch one of them in the middle of one of these deals.
But they didn't have an intelligence unit in 1933.
They did not have an intelligence unit. They had a police department, most of whom were bought and paid for by the mob, as we'll find out. So as this hit goes down, another dark car, a big sedan, comes around the corner, and the sheriff of Jackson County, who was not bought off by the mob, by the way, Tom Bash, and he had a deputy with him, Lawrence Hodges, and his wife and a 15-year-old girl who was probably like a nanny or something, of some helper around the house, were all together coming home. He lived just down the street on Woodland. And they saw this hit go down, so the deputy and the sheriff jumped out of their car. And there was a getaway car waiting for the two guys that had got out and killed Anthon. So they started shooting at that car, and they killed a guy named Sam Scola, or Sammy Hogg, and Gus Fasoni, who were the wheelmen for the hitmen. Tom Bash, the
sheriff. Were those guys shooting back at the police?
Probably not. I don't really, you know, the account I read doesn't really go into that much in detail, but probably not. I think these coppers just jumped out and started shooting. They had shotgun and just started shooting. And the first thing you'd shoot at if you saw somebody in that car would be at that car.
Thinking that that was their getaway.
Right. But the two guys that actually did it, had done the shooting, were on the street on foot. So Bash saw one of them, and he chased him, and he caught him, and it was Charlie Gargatta, one of the two Charlies, the famous two Charlies who will be killed in about 1949 at the Democratic Club up on Truman Road, but we were talking about earlier. And he had thrown away a .45 caliber pistol, and they found it.
Well, I had read this on Wikipedia just today about Gargatta, that he had unloaded his pistol at the sheriff.
At the sheriff, yeah. They had a shootout.
He shot at him. And then threw the pistol down because it was empty.
Yeah.
And said, don't shoot, don't shoot.
That detail slipped my mind that he had already emptied his gun. I remember he's talking about pleading for his life, don't shoot. And Hodges pursued the other guy who had thrown away his pistol. Another thing about these pistols, they were both stolen from a National Guard armory over in Kansas in a big gun theft a few years before. And these guns just kept appearing in different mob situations for several years.
That Lazio was involved in.
Lazio and other people were involved in. And the other guy they found out later, if you remember last week last time we were here, we were talking with Bill Owsley about a mobster named Jimmy Duarte, and his uncle was Gaetano Lococo. And for Kansas Cityans, you may remember the restaurant Gaetano's down at and it's in the River Hills apartment building back in the 70s, 60s and 70s. But anyhow, it was the guy that got away was Gaetano Tano Lococo. And this was kind of the equivalent of the sheriff was catching Gargatta was kind of like the chief of police today catching Corky Savella or Tuffy DeLuna in the middle of a hit. And Lococo got away, but they found out who he was, and they arrested him. They were going to charge him, and they had charged Gargatta. And then the gun that the sheriff had recovered had been put in evidence. And so how this works is a little inside information here. Jackson County, like that, they don't really have their own evidence locker. Kansas City Police has a big evidence locker that has a chain of custody and has somebody working there all the time. So a lot of little departments, even around the city, will put evidence with the Kansas City Police Department
in that locker.
In that locker, because it's always, you know, it's got a log and it's got somebody there 24 hours a day, and they watch it. And so that's the way it was back then. And you know, when they went ready, got ready to go to trial, that gun, it got mixed up. And it got mistagged, and they couldn't find it. And so,
well, they presented it at the court hearing where they were trying to convict him.
Right, right.
And it wasn't the actual gun.
It wasn't the actual gun. And guess what? Gargatta was acquitted.
Now, on Wikipedia, I was just reading about this. They were basically saying that maybe this was when Johnny Lazio was falling out of favor with Tom Pendergast.
Yeah.
And that was why they were having problems, and why that Ferris J. Anthon had the police come around the corner almost immediately after the hit.
Oh, yeah, could be.
That was just Wikipedia.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It seems to me like that had to be just a fluke, because it couldn't have been a setup, because the sheriff would not have taken his wife and that girl. You would not bring your wife. So I think it was just a fluke, and Bash did live down the street. So yeah, I know there's people that think that was a setup by the police, but
then later on there Jackson was a police County officer who was convicted for
messing up the evidence. Right. So, you know, let's go ahead and we're up around 30 minutes. Let's go ahead and stop for now. You know that I like to keep those around 30 minutes, so you guys can listen to these while you commute to work and or go to sleep at night. And
or it over takes your me lunch
about,
break.
No, your lunch break. All those things are about 30 minutes long. I want to give my little public service announcement that I usually do. First call, if you have a spouse, a child, a employee, or another loved one who's having a problem with alcohol or drugs, any kind of addiction, gambling, addiction, a lot of gambling addicts out there with the boats here. Why, make first call your first call. They have all the resources to direct you, the caller, to the right treatment facilities, the right counselors, or the right people who are experts in addiction. Call 816-361-5900 or go to www.firstcallkc.com or
firstcallkc.org.
www.firstcallkc.org, and they have a Facebook page, because I'm always reposting their stuff. It is my favorite organization. So having said all that,
remember to also put a hit out on the donate button if you enjoy these podcasts. They're for free. You can download them and listen to them. Share it with your friends. And check out the Gangland Wire DVD.
DVD, yes.
You can buy it. You could rent it online. Or you could get a t-shirt. I have one of those t-shirts, Gangland Wire.
Yeah. If you give me a donation of $25 or more, I will send you a Gangland Wire t-shirt or a DVD, your choice.
And download the Kansas City Mob Tour app.
And come to our live podcast on November the 4th, 6 to 7, meet and greet myself, Aaron, and Terrence O'Malley. And 7 to 9, you will watch a live podcast being recorded. And about the last 15 minutes, we'll stop recording and we'll take questions. Or will we keep the recording running?
I think we should keep the recording running.
Okay, we'll add that
in. We're actually going to videotape the thing, too.
And we so we can put that up on YouTube when we get done.
Just in case we want to sell it and other people want us to come out and do some live true crime stories at their venue.
Yeah, we'll see how it works. It's the first of a kind. Nobody's ever done this before that I know of, not in Kansas City anyhow. So having said all that, I will say goodnight. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.